on this special episode of the Say What Again, Billy podcast. Today, we're thrilled to welcome Stephen and Leslie Shaw, the brilliant minds behind who they are and what they're up to. A captivating exploration of the ever-persistent mysteries surrounding UFOs and extraterrestrial encounters. With the advent of 2020 came a surge in UFO discussions, propelled further by the government's unprecedented disclosure during a time of global uncertainty. In their groundbreaking book, Stephen and Leslie provide invaluable insights into this mysterious realm, sharing their firsthand accounts of alien abductions and mesmerizing UFO sightings and theories on what these phenomena are. As we embark on this riveting journey, fueled by curiosity and the thirst for understanding, we're compelled to ponder the age-old question: are we truly alone in the cosmos? Could these unidentified flying objects be ambassadors from distant galaxies, navigating the vast expanse of space to reach our humble abode? Or do they hail from the depths of our own ocean, hidden realms teeming with untold wonders? Perhaps, dare we speculate, they originate from the dimensions beyond our comprehension, slipping effortlessly between the fabric of reality. Join us as we delve into the depths of speculation and contemplation, guided by the astute perspectives of Stephen and Leslie Shaw. Together, we'll unravel the intricate tapestries of UFO lore and extraterrestrial encounters, seeking answers to questions that have puzzled humanity for generations. So, dear listeners, fasten your seatbelt and prepare for a riveting odyssey into the unknown. As said in a hit sci-fi show, the truth is out there. This episode of the Say What Again, Billy podcast, featuring Stephen and Leslie Shaw, begins now. Hey, everybody, welcome to a special episode of the Say What Again, Billy podcast. Joining me via phone call, I have two great guests joining us for this episode, Leslie and Stephen Shaw. Welcome aboard, guys.
Hi.
Good evening.
Thank you for having us.
Not a problem. So why don't we start off with you guys telling everybody, the listeners, the book you guys wrote and what got you intrigued to do this book and start you on a course of UFOlogy.
Well, Stephen started experiencing stuff when he was so young that, and when I met him, you know, he told me all about it, and I mostly believed him, but then I saw my own first UFO, and then I 100% believed him.
Right.
I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for about 20 years, and I still work for the paper part-time, but mostly doing copy editing and page layout, and I still do the occasional story for them. But so I was the writer in the family. But Stephen wrote his family's part in the book, and also was my fellow theorist and researcher. He has a much more science background in college than I did, so I really needed his help with all of the scientific parts of the book, especially, you know.
Right.
Stephen?
Well, my motivation was, about the age of 30, I decided I wanted to, you know, get to the bottom of what had been going on in my family for about three generations. I was born a sick individual for the first 2 years of my life with, you know, I had tonsillitis and adenoiditis, which I had to have taken out when I was two. So I did not come into this world healthy, but about the age of three, I was starting to be told by my parents about this family spirit guide we had that would show up to certain people at different periods of their time, mm-hmm. called Ogletley. So when I was 3 years of age, I remember being awakened by this invisible being that would be jumping on my stomach and my abdomen.
Interesting.
Kind of in a playful way. And it happened several different times, and I just accepted it because I knew I grew up in a family that we had like this protector or this spirit guy called Ogletley. So fast forwarding to about the age of 9 or 10, I was sleeping in a bunk bed that time in my life, My brother was three, so he was in the bottom bunk, and I was on the top. And I was awakened in the middle of the night by this unusual sound. I knew the sound of the dog, and it was not the sound of the dog that we had. So I crept out of the bed and was starting walking down the hallway, and my heart was really pounding and racing, and my eyes were dilated, and I knew this is something really strange, and I was definitely in an adrenal state.
I was afraid.
And
yeah.
I was afraid. So just before I turn into the living room, I basically black out. And next thing I remember, about 2 to 3 hours later, I'm back in my bunk bed, just tucked right back in, and I have no clue what happened there.
A lot of family members report something similar. They'll see something strange or bizarre and then immediately black out and wake up again 3 hours later in bed. It seems to happen late at night. It mostly happens in the winter, as far as all the testimony we've written down. And it's the hallmark of the abduction phenomenon, where people have this big black missing time after seeing something strange, and they have their memories tampered with. That's very common too. For instance, Stephen and Philip in their early years, they remember these visitations as kind of looking like gnomes, right, Steve?
Yes, I saw the little gnomes once when I was, again, about 8 or 9 years of age. I looked down off my bunk bed and I saw these, you know, four or five. They looked like little garden gnomes that were just kind of entering the room, and they were kind of shimmery. And later on, when my brother was about, I think between the age of about 6 and 8 or 7 and 9, he started sleeping in our bedroom closet. And I asked him, well, why are you sleeping in the closet? And he said, well, I'm afraid of the little men that come in the night. And he also had a problem with, had trouble controlling his pee too, which is also an indication of being, you know, fearful and scared.
Yeah.
So
and harassed.
So he'd seen the little man too. So I, you know, again, growing up in a family that accepted that we had a spirit guide and a protector, we kind of kept this stuff to ourselves. We didn't tell our friends,
right,
because they think we lived in a haunted house, or we were nuts, or we were just plain lying. Okay. So then when I, about the age of 11, I saw my first UFO. And this UFO, again, it was at nighttime. And it was a large orange globe that was moving from south to north and at a very even pace. I can't remember just how high up it was, but it didn't look like it was that high. And it certainly wasn't going to an airport. And
it sure didn't look like a plane.
I was entranced by it. So I called Griffith Park Observatory the next day and asked them if they had noticed anything. And they said, well, you know, our telescopes are not pointed in that direction. We're pointed toward the moon and the cosmos. So they kind of thought it was a little bit funny. But you know, it's definitely something I saw. And also, during that time period in the 70s, there were mass sightings in the Woodland Hills and Tarzana area of UFOs that were in the news at the time. So it was something that was, obviously, it was my first, okay?
Yes. And then Philip, Stephen's brother, Philip, he had an experience when he was 16. The bizarre phenomenon frequently come in threes or fives, like a bunches of incidents in
different
a row.
House, probably, right?
And different houses. It follows the family wherever they go.
Interesting.
And,
numbers.
Yeah, so
numbers are
like
a big
haunting,
thing.
Right? You know, that sticks to a place usually, right?
Right.
You know? It followed the family. They had two houses for a while because they had one in Southern Cal and they were building one up north. And Philip was at the one up north, and he was 16 years old, and he had a cluster of three experiences over three different nights and maybe a 4-day period. The first one, he awoke to bright lights shining in his window, and as he was staring at them, he then suddenly went black. His memory disappears. Then the next day, he heard a scrabbling sound. He was in bed. He heard a scrabbling sound at the floor, and he reached down to pet what he thought was a cat. And instead, something cold hand grabbed his arm, and he again instantly went black. And then the third night, he saw a gray alien in his room, a tall gray. He said it was about 6 foot tall. and then blacked out again. And this was the first indication that we had that it really was a alien abduction phenomenon, especially since it was finally spotted as being one of them, you know.
Interesting. So can I ask a quick question to Stephen?
Sure.
So this is something that happens pretty much in your family lineage, correct? Like for throughout time.
Yes, and also happened indirectly to family lineage that was married to my family too. My uncle Doug in Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka. But for the most amazing thing that I haven't talked about yet was when I was 18 in 1979. Again in January. And this was an experience that was this is something that happened that is experienced by all five family members, either together or in
at both locations, yeah,
which were 350 miles apart. The first one was the first night. My father was awakened by his closet doors opening and closing on him, and he told me at breakfast time, and I kind of sloughed it off, said, "Oh yeah, Dad, you must have been like dreaming or imagining things or whatever." I didn't, you know, he was not the type of guy to jest. So anyway, the next night I gave him this little book called Metaphysical Meditations to read because I was interested in Paramahansa Yogananda. And so about a half an hour after that, around 9:30 at night, he came into my room and with this quizzical look on his eyes and said, "Stephen, I must be hearing things. I'm hearing a silver bell in the wall." And so I said, "Okay, Dad." So I went into the living room, and sure enough, there's this silver bell being rung inside the 2x4s next to the chimney.
And then they got Karen, and she heard it too.
So then we got my sister, who was 13 at the time, and I said, "Karen, what are you hearing?" And she said, "I'm hearing a silver bell." And so we were like, you know, knocking on the wall, and we were looking up the chimney and trying to make sense of it. Went on for a good 10 or 15 minutes, then it stopped. The next morning, my dad called my mom at the house we were building up in Sonora, California. And she said that he told her about what had happened. She said, "You know that the phone rang about 9:30 at night, and I picked it up, and somebody on the other end was saying, 'I'm the invisible Ambichi,' or something like that." And my brother was in the same room with her because we hadn't had all the house built at that point ourselves yet. And he said that, you know, the phone never rang, but she picked up the phone.
But she heard a ring.
But she heard a ring, and she said it sounded like a bell. So that was something that all five of us experienced at the same time. The next night, I was sleeping in my bedroom on the bottom bunk, and I was awakened by this whizzing sound, like a whiz, whiz, or whew, 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 in the air. And I thought, well, maybe it was a bug or a fan or something like that. And I looked down the hallway, and there's like nothing there. So tried to go back to sleep and turn on my left side. And then from the base of the bed, from the foot of the bed, there were two distinct pushes, kind of gentle, but definite pushes. I was thinking, well, maybe it's a mini earthquake or something because we're in Southern California. So I continued to try to go back to sleep, and then it gets pushed again twice, but harder. And then the third time, even harder. And this time I'm starting to get annoyed and a little scared, right? And then I get three distinct taps on my lower shoulder deltoid area, on my right shoulder, like somebody's tapping me with an index finger. And at this point, I'm really scared and really annoyed. And I whiz around and I say, "What?" And there's nothing there. And then I just black out again. But I knew there was a presence there. I knew there was a presence, but I blacked out. I told my dad about it at breakfast. The very following night, I did not want to sleep in that room anymore. I said, I don't be going through this again. And I was working as a cabinet maker. And
trying to get some sleep.
Trying to get some sleep so I could work, you know.
Right.
So anyways, I went to sleep in my clothes in the living room. And I woke up about 5:30 in the morning. Again, this is January, so it's dark. I looked at my upright piano, think about the music I was going to play that day, and listened to the fountain in the room. In other words, I was awake and I was conscious, okay? And from behind me, from about 25 feet behind me, this presence that was about 6 to 7 feet tall, skinny, that appeared to me, blue-white entity, kind of walked and glided toward me. And the whole room was filled with this blue, white light energy. And it stopped by my right shoulder. It took maybe about a whole of 1.5 to 2 seconds to get to me.
Either glide or glide, walk. We're not sure.
Walking. It was upright. And then it stopped. And my whole right side of my body went frozen, numb. Not really numb, but I was paralyzed, but not in a scary way, but I could not move. And it bent down to me and whispered and into my right ear, said, "Hi, Steve," but in a whisper, like, "Hi, Steve." And I could not tell that it was male or female, but what I was thinking in my mind, I was thinking, oh, I'm going to get to meet the family spirit guide I've heard about since I was like 3 years of age. I'm going to meet old Glegley. And I was thinking, but wait a minute, dude, you can't move. You're paralyzed on the right side of your body. You know, this is not cool. And I was wanting to look, but I knew what it looked like, but I couldn't quite catch the look of the space, but I could tell it was tall and it was definitely blue-white. And it stayed there for an indeterminate amount of seconds. I can't tell if it was 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 seconds, whatever. And then it basically unbent, and it went out of the house. And again, I can't remember what I did.
He thought, when we wrote the book, he said that he went to tell his father right away. But then, on careful reflection, he can't actually remember doing that. So again, there's a memory anomaly associated with this visitation.
So but the end of the story is that 6 hours later, it was 11:30 in the morning, and I wanted to get some lunch for my dad and I, so I reached into my right-hand side pocket to pull out the coins and the dollars that I had and put them on the table, and all the coins were magnetized, or there was some force that had made them to where I could pick up the coins with the coins. They weren't sticky. It was just that they were just basically magnetic. I could pick them up. Like, the nails were all magnetized in my pocket. The coins were magnetized. And this is 6 hours after this happened.
Wow. And this is supposed to be impossible. You know, American coins are specifically designed to not be magnetic and not be magnetized so that they can go into vending machines and, you know, Pepsi machines and cigarette machines,
yeah,
et cetera.
Right.
And then the last thing was the following night, my dad was awakened in the middle of the night to see this blue-white light, this whole wall of blue-white light coming out of my bedroom door. And he was going to get up. As you said, he was getting annoyed himself. He wanted to get up and look to see what was going on. And a voice in his head said, "No, Jeffrey, relax, go back to sleep. Don't worry, there's nothing to see here." And I have no recollection of that experience at all. I have no idea what happened during that. You know, I have no idea whether I was taken or what happened, but he saw it. So.
And then fast forwarding to 2004, in the same year, he saw two more UFOs. The second was a USO coming out of the water off the coast of Malibu and zigzagging around in impossible way and shooting off to the north.
With the valet.
Yeah, the valet parking guy saw it as well with him. And then he saw one hovering, a flying saucer hovering over Yucca Valley coming down the pass. And that was actually a mass sighting.
That was a morning sighting.
Yeah, and that was a lot of people called that one in. And then together, a year later, we were traveling back, and I still was jealous. I still hadn't seen one, you know, and I was a dutiful wife, however, believing every time he told me he was seeing this bizarre stuff. And but I really wanted to see it myself. And sure enough, the next year, we were driving home from an art meeting late at night and from Joshua Tree to Yucca Valley, and up in the ahead through the windshield, I saw a bright white light, and it got brighter and brighter. And I thought maybe a plane flying into Palm Springs Airport, but there were no running lights. And, you know, just this one white light in the center.
Right.
And as we got closer and closer to it, it seemed like it was just hovering, and we were getting closer. And then suddenly it took off north over the northern horizon and gone in about a quarter of a second. It was lightning fast. I would have guessed it at 20,000 miles an hour if I were taking a wild guess. And it took off at speed, too. It didn't ramp up to the speed, you know, and disappear. It slowly get to that speed, just full speed, the inertia would have smushed any normal human and aircraft against the wall, you know?
I try to tell the non-believers that, because with the technology we have now, we have drones that can fly at pretty high rate of speed and video, and we have all these different types of aircrafts. So I try to tell the non-believers that speak to me that if you're manning a ship or something to that size and you're going at those speeds, you're going to be killed at that force. Yeah. And there's no drone.
Even the machinery would be destroyed.
Exactly. There's no drone that could do what these objects are doing. And we're seeing so much of it within the last few years, video evidence, disclosures from the government. And they're saying that these aren't crafts that are ours. They're not, we don't know what they are.
No, the pilots that testified last summer said, this is an order of magnitude of technology beyond ours. It's way beyond ours.
And you know what's very interesting about your stories is I cover all things paranormal, and UFOs fall into this category. And sure. When Stephen was talking earlier and saying that he's waking up, there's loss of time, he's seeing these gnome-like creatures, there's this theory. It's not really a theory, it's more scientifically proven that right before one comes to the end of their life, your brain releases DMT, right? And you know of Aaron Rodgers, the quarterback for the New York Jets, was a former Green Bay Packer. He does ayahuasca, and he goes on these ayahuasca retreats. And one of the telltale visuals of people that do ayahuasca is they see these creatures, these beings, and they see, they're described as gnomes. And these are things that are talked about frequently on the Joe Rogan podcast when he gets into that whole skit about ayahuasca and everything like that. And what's intriguing is your story goes back to a UFO-like alien abduction. And I was just going to ask you that at any point, because, you know, early when these things happen, especially when you were younger, at any point did your family say, you know what, we can't explain what's going on, so let's maybe go to a doctor and see if everything okay? Because there could, I mean, I'm not a doctor or a psychologist or anything in that scientific or medical field, but it sounds like maybe it could be. And as a paranormal investigator, you got to try to go through every logical explanation so that when you're left with no logical explanation, then you could solidify that this is in fact something paranormal or even extraterrestrial or otherworldly. So I was going to ask you, was there any point that you maybe went to a doctor that maybe the DMT being produced in your body that's not...
We tried a hypnotherapist once with him, and it didn't work.
Having been a doctor of Chinese medicine, that kind of stuff, I studied a lot of stuff, including DMT and ayahuasca and, you know, mushrooms and, you know, different things. You study a lot of stuff in Chinese medicine that relate to it a little bit. And DMT is produced in minute quantities in the brain. And of course, you can do things that will enhance DMT, and you will see things that are, beyond the realm. Like, for instance, the old one they used to use, what was it called? That Dracula used, absinthe, you see the green fairy, you know, to change your visual perception. So
it was a hallucinogenic back then.
And as far as, you know, it was one of the things that we kind of kept to ourselves, because like you say, you don't really tell your friends about this kind of stuff.
And it was kind of normalized, right? The whole family was experiencing this. Yeah. You're kind of just chalking it up to another family mystery, you know?
But, you know, the thing with the magnetized coins, that would have nothing, that would have nothing to do with DMT.
That's what I'm saying. Your story, it sounds like it can be conjumbled in the mixture of paranormal as a whole, but then it goes back to things that are strictly like phenomenon of UFO and extraterrestrials, the magnetization of coins that shouldn't be magnetized. You're not going to...
The bright lights in Philip's room. And Philip saw many orb things around his house. It's like they tracked him with these round orbs that would travel up and down his deck.
One particular one.
Yeah, one particular one. He finally got tired of it. He went outside and confronted one on his deck. A different house. And it rushed him and actually went through his chest and out the other side. And we were visiting at the time, and the next day he told me about it. And I looked on his back, and sure enough, there was a bruise coming out of the back of his upper back. And and again, we're all like, yep, another weird family mystery. You know, what can that be?
What we don't really know is that these entities are actually pretending to be family spirit guides or whatever, or protectors.
See, yeah, that's what we think. As we started researching the abduction phenomenon, you know, the book and our experiences, the sightings and our experiences were just the impetus for writing the book. But then that's when the research began, like 20 years ago, or 18 years ago, when I saw my first one, and I thought, well, we should write a book, you know, and started actually doing real research into it. And we discovered quickly that the abduction phenomenon is not what was theorized at the time. At the time, people were saying, oh, aliens are curious about humans. They just want to take some samples and have a genetic library from a cross-section of humanity.
And they're all benevolent.
And yeah, this is just scientific curiosity and nothing, no harm done, right? They take people and put them back, you know. But what we're discovering is that they tend to find a DNA strand that they really like, that meets their parameters for whatever reason they like it. And they prey on that family member they'll prey on that person for years through their lives, taking them again and again and again. And then they'll start taking their children, if they have children, and grandchildren, and the phenomenon tends to stay within families. And in Steve's case, these strange stories of the spirit guide and automatic writing was how they were communicating with this spirit guide, this particular branch of the family. It went back about three generations that they were communicating with this guide, so to speak. And we've come to believe that perhaps they found the strain of DNA, you know, three generations ago that they liked, and they've just been kind of following the family members ever since. And like you would protect any prize animal, perhaps they've actually intervened and saved family members now and then. We've seen it a couple of times, we think, where there's actually like a divine intervention saved a family member. With Stephen, it was one near drowning incident. And then another family member would have been killed. He was warned by the family spirit guide to get out of the situation he was in. And then a raid occurred, and he could have been killed in it. So it's possible that warning saved his life. So we had to approach it from that evidence coming in. And then the most bizarre thing about it is the breeding program. They're actually taking women and impregnating them, and then 4 months later they take them again and steal the fetus. This sometimes happens with women again and again, you know, in their lives, where all their children are stolen away, and then years later they're taken again and sometimes introduced to their hybrid offspring. And this story is remarkably consistent from one of these victims to the next, to the next, to the next.
And the obstetricians with the
Yeah, there's some hard evidence on it too, where some of them were given ultrasounds and proved that they were pregnant, and then 4 months later they get the ultrasound again because they find that the baby is not only is the baby gone, the womb looks like it was never pregnant. It's completely vacuumed out. The placenta is gone. It's like the whole pregnancy, including placenta, was surgically removed or carefully removed anyway, and taken at some point.
Right.
Let me ask you this question. So
sure.
Some of these doctors that when an individual came in and asked for to see if there was they were pregnant and they took their all the tests and everything like that. Would a doctor say, this is remarkable. You 4 months ago, you came and saw me and we saw signs of life. And now 4 months later, you're nothing is there. It's like nothing ever happened.
Yes. From the evidence that I read, the doctors were mystified by it and puzzled is kind of the overall feeling I got from the doctor's testimony.
Oh man, that's great.
That we've read.
So there was a show back in the day I used to watch, one of the very first shows I watched that got me intrigued in the mysterious and strange. And that show was called Sightings. I don't know if you guys remember that show.
Yes.
It was early 90s to mid 90s, popular show. And a lot of things on that show I didn't believe growing up. But there was these alien abductions that were, they had people they interviewed, and there was mysterious objects and cut marks in their body, loss of time again. And what you're saying now, you know, you go back in time, you tell these stories. If we go back 30 years and have this conversation, people would look at you very funny. Just like you didn't want to tell your classmates or other individuals, you wanted to keep it in-house with the family because it was a family ordeal. But you have these conversations with people now, and for the most part, there's people that are like, yeah, this is going on. And there's very famous stories that coincide to everything you're saying. Benny and Barney Hill, that's a very famous story. They went to a hypnotist because they had trouble.
Yes, very much. A very, very famous story about it.
Exactly. They had trouble remembering things. And it was the hypnotist that confirmed that every time they came in and hypnotized them, they told the same story from a part of their brain that holds these memories that wouldn't come out other than me hypnotizing them or them remembering bits and pieces. And they were horrified every time they went to hypnosis. Barney, there was recordings of Barney literally yelling in anguish.
Screaming and the searing pain that Betty reported when they stuck the needle in her side.
Yes.
And they drew the same type of pictures, too, independently, as far as what the inside of the vehicle looked like, too.
Right.
And we've since learned that Betty's sister and her sister's daughter, so Betty's niece, were also being taken. So we believe that in that particular
they had that
instance,
gene.
They were, Betty was the main target.
Perhaps. Right, they had that gene that you're talking about, that bloodline, that gene that they were interested in to preserve.
Exactly. They're after that in particular. And we think that they're, you know, it's hard to see past the veil of their intentions based on their actions. But we do know about this hybrid breeding program, and the way I see it is that it may be a way of infiltrating our society.
Or reintroducing.
Yes,
I was going to say what Stephen said is reintroducing, because the Anunnaki is a very, very popular story and theory. And you look at Egyptian hieroglyphics and cave paintings, and some of the things they drew cannot be identified as what was around at that time period. So there is the theory that these beings, whether they're aliens or interdimensional beings or something from the deep, deep oceans, depths of the ocean, that there's a theory that they were here already. And this reintroducing is something.
And they've been with us for thousands of years. And they really are us. And in a way, in that we think they split, they're a branch of humanity that split away from us thousands and thousands of years ago. And we think it was at the time when the Younger Dryas and Ucello boundary soil layers were laid down. And we're not entirely sure now when this exactly happened as far as where the crater is on this impact.
We know when it happened.
But we know when it happened, and we know that it was a celestial impact. I'm sorry, Steve, I stepped on you there. We know that because the nanodiamonds in the soil point to a celestial impact 13,000 years ago. And whichever crater it was that caused this impact, we know it happened and it caused the extinction level event in North America.
And the flash freezing of all the animals in Siberia.
In Siberia, yeah, the mammoths and them too, flash frozen almost instantly. And who knew there were more than one crater under the ice sheet north in the North American Greenland area, right?
It could be, Lake Superior.
But at any rate, we know that it still happened and that the source of the flood myths were probably, in our opinion, from that time period.
And there was forewarning, too.
Yes, and we know that all these stories talk about how they had forewarning that this this impact was coming. So we're looking at a civilization, pre-flood civilization, before 13,000 years ago, that at least had advanced astronomy. And we think we're a fairly advanced race, maybe even spacefaring. And they may have been the ones that built this stuff on Mars, the stuff that's been found on the moon and Phobos.
Very interesting. Interesting thing about Mars, and we discussed this in one of our episodes. But if you look at, there's three formations on Mars that are almost identical. If you do a picture comparison to the pyramids in Egypt, there's
The site of Sidonia is very like the Gaza Plateau.
Exactly like it. And there's
you find that on the bottom of the ocean floor. You find these same layouts sometimes. There's one in 2,000 feet of water off of Cuba. And that's supposedly that hasn't been in the air for I don't know how many thousands of years. Over 50,000 years. Since the ocean levels were that low, we're talking about mid ice age now. You know,
right?
For the ocean levels to be that low, and there's this bizarre pyramid complex down there.
So
we're definitely talking about a distant past that. I'm sorry, I stepped on you.
No, it's okay.
We think that before this impact that caused this extinction level event and probably an enormous tsunami, we think that humanity might have split into two different sections. One that kept their technology and their knowledge with them because they escaped the cataclysm. And the rest of us poor schmucks that were left on the surface to die in droves and barely survive. And go, you essentially have to start over in the by being cavemen again, 13,000 years ago.
So we have the way of confirming too now that there was a genetic bottleneck that occurred about 13,000 years ago too, where the human race was reduced to about 10,000 individuals. So we are less genetically diverse
than
we should be.
Yeah, and before this bottleneck of only 10,000 individuals, we were much more diverse than we are now. And the bottleneck is sometimes attributed to a volcanic eruption 79,000 years ago, and sometimes it's attributed to this younger Dryas era impact time period. So it's still arguable, but certainly if the tsunamis that we think happened. We're talking about 2,000 foot high tsunamis rushing to every coastline of the world. And this shared flood myth experience that's in the most ancient lore of 1,200 separate cultures all over the world, it points to a worldwide event, of course, of some enormous import. And we believe that it's a celestial impact 13,000 years ago that separated our race into two. And, like the Deep Impact movie where they, in order to escape this killer asteroid that's coming, they make these deep underground arcs and put all our technology down there and pick our healthiest, the smartest, wisest, people and put them down there. And we think that may be exactly what happened. And now this society, and maybe more than one of these societies, sunk down in the ground, have been living there for thousands of years.
So let me ask you a quick question, because we're on this discussion of there was advanced people here that would eventually split up. The advanced people,
right. The
advanced people got lucky and alluded. You're alluding to that they might have went underground while everyone else...
Or escaped into space,
Yes. So there's we have an ongoing discussion. It comes up sporadically on episodes. We've had designated episodes for this. The pyramids. Do you believe they were built by the Egyptians at that time period, or were there other entities or beings at the time that were advanced that built them? Because there's a lot of things when it comes to that alone that don't add up. And there's parts of Egypt, the Seraphim of Saqqara, where they have these perfectly cut granite tombs that were made for bull at the time.
Yeah, not just perfectly cut, but machine perfect.
Diamonds. Yes, diamond cut. Yes. So
yes, exactly.
I'm asking aficionados in this, do you believe that the Egyptians built the pyramids?
Well, we think that after the floodwaters receded and humanity was in existence, but still very primitive and basically returning to barbarism and cannibalism, we think some of these people, that survived the cataclysm with their technology intact, took pity on us poor slobs on the surface. Many flood myths, in fact, most of them, end with a story about how we were barbarians after the flood, and then God came back and taught us math again and civilization again. And we think that they returned to the surface in family groups that were essentially viewed on as gods and became the pantheons of the first dynasty of Egypt. And so they brought their technology back to the surface with them. And it was they who constructed the pyramids. Now, we're talking about a much, much earlier time period. Sitchin, I like Sitchin's theory on it. He puts them at 10,000 years ago. So after the flood of 13,000 years ago, after the waters receded, some of the technology returned to the surface and constructed these pyramids that are way too advanced for the populations to whom they're being attributed.
Absolutely.
They're copper tool users that they're attributing the Great Pyramid to. And it's lined with rose quartz that you cannot shape rose granite quartz. I'm sorry. You can't shape granite with a copper tool. You just cannot do it.
Yeah. I tried to say that. I have a mutual friend, very into history, has his own TikTok page, and we brought him on. We had a debate and we tried to explain that there's these things that don't make sense, things that can't be done. Modern engineers cannot answer how they did that, especially the Seraphim of Saqqara, especially those with the precise pinpoint, like diamond cut. And then the hieroglyphics that were etched onto it after, like archaeologists see that these were made perfectly, but the hieroglyphics are very sloppy. It looks almost as someone came along, saw these, and it's like graffiti. I'm going to put the hieroglyphics here, but it doesn't match the art.
Yeah, I'm going to chisel into it, you know,
yes.
Kilroy was here.
Exactly. Now, I wanted to fast forward to things that are going on now. There was a video I posted today, one of the best, they're saying, UFO sightings ever taken. I posted that video, I believe it was from Colombia. They were in a plane, they filmed it, this object shoot past them. It didn't look very big, but it looked orb in shape, like almost two sizes basketball, maybe three together, shot past them. We have David Grosch coming out and doing congressional hearings. Jeremy Corbell speaking publicly, letting all the cats out of the bag at this point. Bob Lazar literally being justified in everything he said back in the day. Everything he said back then, you know, being raided by the FBI. What are your thoughts and opinions on the stuff that's going on currently here with UFOs, UAPs now?
Yeah, in our book, we had to assume that a non-ufologist might pick up the book. So we started, chapter one is essentially a crash course in UFO activity for the past 80 years. And then chapter two was about the new disclosure policy. That was an enormous difference. For 80 years, they just stonewalled us and said, this is not happening. It's swamp gas or mass hysteria.
Oh, don't forget weather balloons. Yep.
Yeah. But they would send these men in black. I know it sounds like the movie, but these men in black would show up, gather all the information for themselves, interview all the witnesses, and get all the testimony for the information they would keep for themselves. And then they would run these ridicule campaigns to embarrass people into silence. If that wouldn't work, then they would use threats, you know, and we think it would even escalate into if people won't shut up, that maybe they get fired from their jobs or they get some sort of repercussions that way, and possibly even murdered. So this is happening for 80 odd years. And then suddenly Luis Elizondo releases these three videos to the New York Times in 2017. And the Tic Tac, the Go Fast, and the Gimbal videos, very important videos, right? Mm-hmm. And the Big Times article comes out. And then the Department of Defense surprises us all and says, oh, this is a real phenomenon. It's really happening. Never mind what we said for the last 80 years.
And they strategically did it during a pandemic.
Yes, conveniently when it was hard to follow, you know.
Yes, exactly.
And it seemed like for a minute that they were going to be more open and trusting with the public and release more information, but no, we still have to claw it out of them.
Yeah, everybody keeps asking me like, oh, look, they're releasing things. And I said, listen, you know, one particular friend of mine, his name is Charlie. I says, you know, I'll be honest with you, the David Grosh hearing, you know, because
they're trying to go after him. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't really impressed what he said, except for the part where he said these things did harm personnel and military members of service. That intrigued me because, you know, that's like, oh, you don't expect that. People see things, but you never hear about potentially being harmed. You know, it's like very rare stories.
Yes, people that get too close to UFOs. See, UFOs are mostly silent, but when people hear a sound, it's usually recorded as like a humming sound that they more feel.
Yeah, Travis Walton.
Than they hear. But if you're that close, you're too close.
Right.
And end up with these radiation burns.
That's why I alluded to Travis Walton. I remember his story. I believe he said he heard like this humming sound and he got thrown back and himself had the loss of time. And it's interesting stuff. But that's what intrigued me about the David Grosh, you know, hearing is him saying,
you know, the hearing, the big bombshell for me during that hearing, and Stephen agrees, is this, it was the pilot's testimony. I mean, we knew from our research that, yes, the government has crashed UFOs, and yes, they have biologics. We knew that. And we knew that sometimes some of these biologics survived for a time, and we don't know if they still have them alive or not. Of course, they're not sharing that. But the pilot's testimony, I believe it was Graves especially, says, what's happening is that every time our military goes out on maneuvers anywhere all over the world, these things are following them. And so we believe they are very worried about our nuclear weapons. And they're basically monitoring our nuclear weapons everywhere they go, every when they go, every time they go out on maneuvers.
Russia, China, doesn't matter.
And the other big superpowers as well. It's like they're monitoring where these nuclear weapons are at all times. And I think it's because they know they can disarm them if they have enough warning time. Yeah,
which has been done.
Yes, we know that the Malmstrom incident and the Minot incident too, and a few other nuclear base incidents.
They've even activated them and shut them off.
Yes.
Yep. And just showing us what they can do, you know.
Well, I hope for everybody's sake, because I would love to see a part two to this book, that they're monitoring closely now with everything going on in the world. I really hope they're, you know, giving a close look at every superpower with all the nuclear talk and all the war stuff going on now. I hope they're looking after us, because it's crazy out there.
Yes, I actually was comforted when I realized that they could turn off our nukes anytime they want to. I was actually, I breathed a sigh of relief. But the reason we think that they're so involved with our nuclear weapons is because they live here too. They're not visiting here from distant star systems. They're dug inside our planet, and they're in bases all around our solar system.
Yeah.
And they have motherships up in the sky that are cloaked. I've heard of testimony from friends and other people I've read that where they were looking straight at a mothership, big UFO in the sky, and it just disappears right in front of them.
Well, so. I strongly believe the Arizona Light incident was definitely a mothership incident. And, you know, the mayor at the time of Phoenix, Arizona, he kind of wrote it off, and he dressed up in an alien costume and made a joke.
Yes, he tried to make a joke.
He made a joke, but then he came back. Yeah. And redacted everything so many years later and says, yeah, this was a real thing. And
he was scared, actually, by it, you know, and so he was worried there'd be a panic. And
I can say for a fact that our U.S. military, because I did my 6 years military in the Navy. I was a CV from 2000 to 2006. But I mean, from 1980 to 1986, sorry. But in about 2006, I was with a group of friends over at Giant Rock, which is, you know, 3 miles away from the Integratron, which is in basically not Johnson Valley, it's Landers.
Landers. Mm-hmm.
In Landers. And, you know, the Integratron was made by George Van Tassel. It's made to be like a time traveling machine, but it's
an alien machine for staying young.
Yeah,
too,
it was a very interesting thing, and he also died very mysteriously. But anyway,
right, Murphy, we believe
a group of us. We went to Giant Rock, which used to be the largest boulder in the world, and it's got its own history about it. But anyways, so about 9 o'clock at night, the full moon comes up, and we're all doing our thing, right, whatever, and we see these two black objects come flying towards Giant Rock about 200 feet in the air. And I said, oh, those are helicopters, okay? They're totally black, no markings on them, and they're absolutely soundless. And then they make like a turn, like a loop right around Giant Rock, and they go back to the military base.
Right over their heads. You know?
Right over our heads. And if there hadn't been, you know, the moon there, we would have had no clue. And this was in 2006, so that we know, I know for a fact that our military does have at least sound canceling.
Yeah, they've reverse engineered how to be silent anyway.
Right.
From the UFOs that they've reverse engineered some of the technology out of, you know.
Interesting stuff. I mean, Bob Lazar had told everybody that they're doing things with reverse engineering technology that we don't have. And what we're seeing now via thank God for social media, otherwise we wouldn't see some of this stuff. And I don't think a lot of the information would have came out if it wasn't for the impact. That's one of the positives of social media, is the impact.
I agree.
But there's also negatives to it. You know, people try to fake videos in that nature, but there's a lot of positive.
Yeah, so everyone's got a camera now, though, so they couldn't hide it forever, I think.
Exactly.
That's why I think they're finally at least disclosed the fact that the phenomenon is real, and they don't know what it is, so that's another lie, right? Because we know they know exactly what it is, but
right.
They have the ships, and they have the crashed ships and the biologics in their custody. But, you know, so they're still lying to us, and they're still punishing whistleblowers. They're still going after Grush for his testimony, and they're you know, trying to throw him in jail for whistleblowing.
And they keep having us look in the wrong direction.
Right. When they keep... We think these creatures that, as we said, that were that came back to the surface as set themselves up as gods with pantheons, their family members as pantheons, like the Greeks were always, the Greeks had a 12 gods, right? The Egyptians had 12 gods. The Sumerians had 12 gods. They always came in groups of 12.
Romans.
And, yeah, the Romans. And they always came in groups of 12 and ruled the area as gods. And now we think that they can't fool us anymore. We've gotten too sophisticated for the god angle to work. And we think now they're playing space alien instead. Remember when Valiant Thor was, did you remember that story where this alien lands in a spaceship in a field in Virginia in the 50s, wasn't it, Stephen?
Yeah, it was a mid-50s.
And he's at the Pentagon as an advisor and at the White House as an advisor for some 3 years. And this guy who arrives, Valiant Thor, guess what? He's a human. He looks exactly like a Caucasian man with red hair.
White guy.
Yeah, a white Caucasian man with red hair. So we think that this split off of the family, the human race family, some of them maybe stayed underground a long time and are, that's what came into becoming the grayish aliens, you know, with the big dark eyes.
Yeah.
That's what I see when I see a gray alien in my mind. I see a human being that's been underground for 13,000 years, maybe, you know, with the bigger eyes and the darker expanding pupils and no hair, right? You don't need hair underground, and much more pale, too. And, you know, the fact that they can communicate with us telepathically, to me, says that they are maybe have the same brains, the same kind of brain, and are closer cousins than people are talking about. We don't think they're coming from distant star systems, in other words. And, you know, our theory means you don't have to have wormholes. You don't have to have time travel. You don't have to have interdimensional travel. Just good old-fashioned rocketry back and forth from Mars to here.
It's very interesting. I've heard people say underwater. I've never really delved into the idea of under Earth, and that's very intriguing, and it could definitely make sense. I can't wait to play this episode back for my co-host Joey, because this is so his field. This is like he tries to go into this stuff and turn every page and link it with things in history that don't make sense, like the pyramids, and that's such an interesting theory.
Yeah, that's us, all right. That's what we like to do too.
Now, the other thing I find intriguing too about the grays is that the fact that human beings, we make terrible slaves. You know, we just don't like being slaves. We're rambunctious,
too willful.
We're too willful. We criticize.
Fight.
We just fight. You know, all the stories going back to the Bible, that Tower of Babel and whatnot. We just don't make good slaves. So, quite frankly, over the past 13,000 years, the Greys may be a partially manufactured genetic race that. It's
like a slave race.
It's more like a slave race that does not have the same, you know, the seven deadly sins that we all have, you know, the greed, gluttony, lust, vanity, pride, wrath, and sloth. And so if you're going to make a race that was going to serve your needs, certainly
still intelligent, but not emotional. Yeah.
Certainly don't make them human, not the same.
we think maybe this is the case because abductees keep describing the grays the same way. They're very goal-driven. They never look around wondering what to do next. They always know what they're doing next. They're never confused about what they're doing. They are always emotionless, completely emotionless. No matter how much emotion they're causing in their victims, they don't react to it in any way emotionally. So it's possible that this race of beings that separated and stayed underground, they may have been enslaved by what we call the Nordics. The Nordics are the ones that we think came back to the surface as gods around 10,000 years ago, between 10 and 5,000 years ago. And they were doing the giant pyramid building all over the world. Sites at Pumapunku and Sacsayhuaman and Cusco and Karlsruhe, and Machu Picchu.
And they always look the same, two tall white guys with long hair.
Yeah, they the the supposed gods that were building these things, they are depicted as Caucasians with beards, you know, and the people in the region don't have those qualities.
That's
right.
That's very interesting. I'm going to hold that thought. We're going to take a momentary pause, and I'm going to ask you a question about the tall white Caucasian with the red hair. We're going to take a momentary pause.
All right.
And we're back from our momentary pause. So we were talking about these tall white Caucasians, red hair. Yes.
And the Nordic aliens.
Right. Nordic aliens. And there's this very big thing on social media, and I've covered it a few times. It's not really my thing, but to appease my fans, I did cover it. The Nephilim. And there's stories of giants in Afghanistan fighting off military from the United States with red hair, throwing spears at them and killing them. And obviously that story is fake, but that's how they're often described. So do you think there's any affiliation with this basically shunned upon book, lost book of the Bible and the Nephilim?
Yes, definitely. The Book of Enoch, right?
You mean, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where he's talking about
The Ethiopian Bible, yes.
Right. When, you know, people hear about our theories about the people flying the UFOs in our skies as being a separate branch of humanity, they sometimes ask, you know, well, are aliens involved at all? And we had to say maybe, because the evidence of uplifting of our race around 300,000 years ago seems like it may actually have happened, in which case aliens must be involved, and the Anunnaki stories may be truly alien people, because we couldn't have uplifted our own selves, right? You know,
right. That's
that wouldn't make any sense. For instance, I went to a lecture with Jason Martell, and Martell was showing a lot of stuff, and I wrote a lot of it down. But my knowledge of the human brain is for instance, like our new neocortex is the newest part of the human brain. It's really what makes us Homo sapiens sapien instead of Homo sapien. And there is Broca's brain that Carl Sagan talked about, which is our speech center. And according to Jason Martell and other recent research, is that it looks like on our neocortex, because, you know, the human genome is based on four base pairs, adenine, cytosine, I forget the other two, but anyways, it's based on four basic pairs. And as far as for the speech center, it looks like about 300,000 years ago, there was literally like CRISPR technology that was done on us, a cut and paste that basically activated our ability to speak. So there's that there. And also too, the uplifting, as far as at that time, the Anunnaki, of course, the stories go that the Anunnaki they grew tired of mining for gold themselves. And so Enki came along and said, well, maybe I can take Homo erectus and make a slave out of Homo erectus. So the story goes as far as like the 50 princes that came down from space, like the Anunnaki. And there's different interpretations. One is that the Anunnaki that stayed up in space stayed the Anunnaki, but the ones that came down to Earth, they were called the Nephilim.
Or that sometimes the Nephilim are the offspring between the Anunnaki and humans. It's a
right.
little bit confused.
It's a little confusing. Sometimes
Sitchin called them Nephilim. Is the Anunnaki were the Nephilim, but a lot of scholars believe that the Nephilim were the children of the Anunnaki mixed with humans, and that's why they were giant.
Right, and in correlation with the Book of Enoch, the Nephilim were the offspring of the angels and the humans, which God said, you cannot do that. That's one of the things he
right.
said you cannot do. And then eventually the angels, you know, they bred with the humans and created the Nephilim. So it's a really very big comparison and very corresponding to what your guys are saying.
Has a long story about, you know how in the Bible, if you look in Sitchin's translations, a lot of times the biblical stories actually originated thousands of years before in the Sumerian tablets.
And then Babylonia.
And Babylonia after that, and Akkadian between. But one of the things Sitchin translated had to do with the Adam and Eve story, Eden is actually a location in Mesopotamia at that time, except they spelled it E-D-I-N. And it was a region where there were gardens, and supposedly the Anunnaki were ruling this area. And they had humans as slaves. And but in the Sumerian version, it isn't an apple that Eve eats that infuriates God to expel them all. What it is the heresy of interbreeding with the Anunnaki, other Anunnaki, what irritated him so much.
Enlil.
And yeah, the god Enlil was in charge of this area of Mesopotamia, supposedly. And it infuriated him. This heresy of interbreeding with the gods infuriated him. And he kicked all of his human slaves out of Eden. And this is the expulsion. It makes more sense to me. Why would somebody get furious over somebody eating a fruit? But you know, if you're sleeping with a god and having bizarre hybrid giant asshole children, you know, then yeah, I can see where he'd get all mad about it, you know, and actually decree them to get kicked out of Eden, you know. So it's so funny that they have their own Tower of Babel story, too, where they didn't, it wasn't that they were building a tall tower, it's that they were trying to create space travel for themselves. They were trying to build a launch tower, and this infuriated the Anunnaki to the point where they knocked down the tower and they scattered the people that were doing it to the four winds and forced them to change their language and stuff like that. It wasn't because they just made the tower too tall. It was that they were trying to steal the power of the gods.
Interesting.
John, I don't approve of your poor girlfriend. She doesn't come from a good family.
That is so interesting. So what is your theory on the Ark of the Covenant? Because you if you read the Bible, you couldn't touch it. It was made in certain measurements where poles were put through it, and only in certain individuals, select individuals were able to carry it. It had to be covered when it wasn't being carried. So what is?
It sounded to us like alien, like advanced technology of some right. kind, some sort of dangerous technology. We don't fully understand it because you know it's all written in biblical ease, you know, where it's
right.
like hard to follow the facts.
You know what's really crazy about this is that, you know, the Bible and stories around the world when it comes to religion, they're all very eerily similar. And even what you're saying with the Anunnaki, it's so similar that if you have someone with an open mind and you tell them, or they're listening to this episode, and they have an open mind, they may make them raise an eyebrow like, interesting.
Well, believe me, as I was researching the stuff, I was thinking, oh my God, this is the position I have to take? Sometimes it's like, wow, could it be weirder? You know, could it be any weirder? Especially when I started to understand about the abduction and breeding, interbreeding program that they're doing. I thought, what the hell?
As a kid,
there's a really interesting book that I read back in the early 80s. It's called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, that touches on a lot of the stuff as far as like, you know, Jesus being, you know, sacrificed, not on the big mount, but actually in the Garden of Gethsemane, and with the whole issue with Pontius Pilate. And it gets into things like the, of course, the Grail and things such as that. And Dan Brown kind of used that as some of his background of research for his books, you know, the ones, what were the ones that were
the Da Vinci Code, the first, and I forget stuff. The second one, though.
But it was really interesting. Go back in the late 70s when this stuff was written, as far as what really was happening is not what, you know, conventional religion, you know, King James Bible talks about. It's different.
It's like the Bible was rewritten for children at some point, you know, or very, very non-sophisticated people to help them understand. And, you know, a lot of times, for instance, like just the Noah thing, for instance, they said, and then it rained 40 days and 40 nights. The actual time period, you can add a zero to that. It, probably rain 400 straight days and nights, you know?
Yeah, I think scientists...
After the cataclysm, right?
I think scientists also tried to debunk the whole Noah's Ark, that it would have been... For the water to cover the entire Earth like that, it would have had to rain for like 30, 40 years straight, nonstop. Something, I'm paraphrasing. No,
but for instance, we studied Hiawatha, and it may not be the right time period, but if an asteroid the size of Hiawatha had struck the ice sheet when we surmised that it did, it would have vaporized 1,500 gigatons about of ice and into water vapor. That's enough water vapor to cover half the planet in a few minutes.
Right, right. If that happened, I was referring to people trying to debunk the actual Bible story where it just rained, because it'd be impossible. But obviously, your theory of
it never covered the entire planet with water, but the tsunamis would have been very, very high. You know, the city of Derinkuyu, the underground city on the, it's in the middle of the Anatolian plateau of Turkey. It's at about 4,700 foot elevation, and it's about 300 miles in every direction from the, any body of water, large body of water. So, we believe the wave would have crested maybe over the Anatolian plateau, and that's why they dug in. And that's why they were able to survive by digging down underneath. Or it's possible the water never reached that far in.
Is this also the place where people are saying they found Noah's boat on top of this mountain? Is that the same?
That's on the shoulders of Mount Ararat. They found a valley that looks very much like the shape of a boat. And it does look like it has, when they did ground penetrating radar, and it looks like it has
wood,
little partitioned chambers inside of it. So it certainly could be the real thing, you know, where they were warned in advance to all over the world. The flood stories talk about being warned in advance.
But Derinkuyu, the city we're talking about, it was, the god was Uhura Mazda, right?
Yeah, and King Yima, he warned King Yima. This is the story that he Uhura Mazda came to Yima and said, build a city underground because there's going to be a winter that like nothing you've ever seen before. You have to dig underground to save your people. And so apparently he had long enough to dig a city underground. Of course, you know, you can, when people get going,
13 stories deep.
It went, yeah, very, very deep, and we think, and it's sealed from the outside. The inside, they were able to seal it from the outside. So even if the tsunamis had reached it, it would have crested over the city, and nobody would have been wiped away, right? And then the climate change that happened afterwards plunged right back into an ice age, and they had to remain in the city probably for, you know, we don't know how long before they were able to come back out, and the tide waters had receded enough and the climate had calmed down, looking like 1,100 years maybe had to pass.
If you think about the planning that went into this, it's at least 13 levels deep. The upper levels were for housing for like animals.
Yeah, they had stables.
They had stables, and also these cities would connect about every 10 or 20 miles would be like another city they found.
Right.
These things, they had wine vats, they had churches, they had housing for about 20,000 people.
They had underground rivers, they had water. Vents,
they had wells.
Sewage areas.
It was so well planned out. You know, again, architects, they think, we would have trouble building this today.
Absolutely.
I mean, how quickly they did it. They did it in such a short period of time, apparently.
Probably a couple of years. I mean, how far can we see in advance an asteroid coming? Probably about a year and a half, maybe, if we get lucky. Maybe less, you know, if we don't. And if they're coming from the sun direction, then we can't see them at all, which is really scary, actually.
Yeah, I don't think we would have much of a chance, even if we had forewarning, to do what some of these primitive people at the time did, building underground. Now, that's interesting about the underground stories, because I'm not really sure. I haven't really looked that much into it. And the only thing that made me look into it was I was an Indiana Jones fan. The Petra in Jordan, I believe.
Yeah.
That it goes into a cave and a little bit underground. Do you guys think there's any correlation with beings.
You know, I have a funny story about Petra. I studied ancient art history as my minor in college, and it was always called the Lost City of Petra. The English were writing all the textbooks back then, and the textbooks were like, we've heard of this lost city of Petra, but we can't find it. And then finally somebody went to the area and asked the Bedouins, like, where the city of Petra was. And he said, oh, it's not lost. It's just over there. You know, they just never bothered to, these snobbish English dirks never bothered to ask the local people where it was.
that place is, the way they did that at the time, carving into a mountain and making it look the way it looks, always baffles me.
It in back to it. It was really quite interesting how they did it. But I'm actually more impressed, and I believe it was probably a pre-flood structure, was the Hypogeum on Malta. That that structure is beyond, it's essentially a pyramid that goes underground. You know, built inverted, like down into the ground, and it's just bizarre. You know,
it resonates at exactly
110
hertz.
The whole audio of the entire underground area resonates at the same hertz, like it was auditorily designed as well.
You can hear somebody across the room whispering.
And there's bizarre stories about the Hypogeum. One of them was a woman. Separated from her group and went down a passageway that opened out onto a huge cavern. And she looked down and across the cavern and saw this group of men. They were tall, white-haired, pale men, and they were gesturing to her to come with them. And, of course, she didn't go with them.
Yeah,
she
sounds a little horrifying.
Yeah, and ran back to her group. This was from the 20s. And, you know, maybe it's a lie and maybe it's not, but it's one more of many stories we have about underground, tall, white, pale, Caucasian persons that we think are this split off race from us. And we think they have several underground bases. We think the Hypogeum may be one of the very deepest parts of the Hypogeum, may be part of their realm as well. The Mount Kailash in Tibet, we know, is part of their realm. Mount Shasta and the Black Pyramid in Alaska, we believe, and also Mount Hayes in Alaska, we believe are underground bases or cities. That
Antarctica too.
And
I was going to say Antarctica is a big one.
Yeah, Admiral Byrd about Antarctica and the whole Nazi thing. That's another thing. When I was realizing Nazis actually were involved, I thought, oh my God, could this be any weirder?
Well, Hitler had a very big fascination with the occult. So yeah, he had Nazis doing Antarctica. A lot of weird things. Yeah.
Society.
And they put all this resources into Antarctica for some reason. And, you know, and then there was this, did you ever see this Russian documentary about the attack, the flying saucer attack on
in the water,
Armada, Operation High Jump, the Armada?
No, I didn't hear about that one.
Yeah, it's a Russian documentary based on a intelligence report about Operation High Jump, and it was published on Russian television in I think 86 it was or 96 maybe, and you can find it online, and of course they have it translated. Did I lose you, Billy?
No, I'm still here.
No, okay, my phone made us wiggle, so I thought it did. but anyway. It talks about Operation High Jump being attacked by flying saucers that come up out of the water and attack them. And it happens to fit some of the facts we do know about Operation High Jump. Like, they went down there for a 6-month mission, and what happened was is they turned tail and ran about 2 months into the mission and ran back to South America. And Byrd actually gave an interview talking about how we had an enemy that could fly from pole to pole within seconds.
Interesting.
And then there's the Byrd's diary that we think we think it corresponds to time of Operation High Jump. He says it's at the same time, and he flew his plane into a hole in the ice and into a deep, deep cavern that had a crystal city at one end of it. And his plane was forced to land by flying saucers, and he met with men. There were men living in this underground city. And, you know, tall, white-haired, Nordic-looking, Nordic-sounding, too. He said they had a Germanic accent, like a Nordic type of accent. And they essentially met with him and told us through Admiral Byrd that they usually leave us alone because they think of us as barbarians. Is we normally don't have anything to do with you people and your barbaric wars and your barbarism on the surface. We're happy to live here alone and never have anything to do with you. But now that you have nuclear weapons, you're a threat to the entire world. And we're worried you're going to blow up the world. And also we're going to take some of your humanity and safekeep them. Mm-hmm. This is like explaining to hear their version of the abduction phenomenon, right?
Right.
In case we do blow ourselves up. But essentially, and then we think the Nordics met with Eisenhower and had this, you know, treaty where they tried to get us to denuclearize and we wouldn't do it. But we at least agreed to keep their secret of their existence and not interfere with them taking the samples they needed, right? The abductions they needed.
That
we stopped them anyway.
Right.
And then they would share some of their dribs and drabs of technology with us. And we think that's how this uneasy truce is still holding.
That part I've heard about the meetings with Eisenhower. I've heard that we've had contact and these very secretive meetings, and they've given us little bits and pieces of technology, and that's why we have things today that we do. And it's very interesting. Very interesting. I actually never really thought to go that in depth with the underground theory, which is actually horrifying to me because I have two fears. One is flying, and the second one is doing anything subterranean, anything going underground, caves, any of that.
Even with a cave, what do you call it?
Spelunker?
I was an advanced spelunker in my early 20s.
Oh, no, no.
Cave explorations where you go through like these mud caverns you have to squeeze through.
No, and kind of, no, dude. Count me out. Count me out of that.
I'm more with you, Billy. I didn't want to do it.
No, I'm not even claustrophobic. It's just going underground. There's a place near me. It's upstate New York, and it's called House Cavern. And you take this elevator ride like 200, 300 feet below the earth, and you go to this cavern, and it's like 20 degrees down there. It's cold. And yeah. I was horrified on the whole elevator ride down. I don't know why my mom made me do this. And then they put you on a boat, and the boat goes on this little, like, there's a stream down there. It's like 2-3 feet deep. And then the boat goes all the way down this river. Underground, and there's a waterfall, and there's it's all underground, and there's this river's underground, and you're going towards this black hole, and you hear water falling, and the tour guide's like, yeah, that's a waterfall, and the only thing that came through my mind is it's pitch black, but you can hear the water falling, and I was like, if this boat goes past that rope, which was the only thing holding the boat from going forward, and you had to get off at that point and continue walking. I was like, what's on the other side? What do you fall down into? It's pitch black. I was horrified. That's what did it in for me for anything underground. I was like,
I saw some of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. And it was only because I got this group of my friends when I was like 21 to go with me to Cave City in California, which I'd done before. You're down about 200 or 300 or 400 feet. You know, and there's like rivers, and also there's a lake down there too, which you can swim across if you're brave enough. But we got to go to this what's called the Crystal Waterfall that only about 20 other people had seen at that point because it was recently discovered. And it's all these quartz crystals, but clear. And it's like about 12 feet long, and it's this like this waterfall just frozen in time. Hmm. And then we crawl through this other room to go in what's it called, the jewel box, and it had all this like mica on the wall and all these like soda straws they call coming out, and just this fantastic stuff that nature makes. And the funny thing is, if you're down in the cave during an earthquake, you won't even feel the earthquake. You're actually safer in a cave,
which is one of the reasons we think they sort of stayed underground after they'd been down there for a long time. If the Younger Dryas Boundary is any indication, it's about 1,100 years of climate upheavals from whatever caused the Ucello Horizon, and this cataclysm would have made it hard to grow crops. It would have made it hard to live on the surface, and so it makes sense that why go back to the surface? Why not stay down here where we're safe? You know.
Yeah, we found out too, right?
And that's many generations of humans, 1,100 years, right? So after a while, it's like we would have bred a whole society of agoraphobes down there, you know?
That's very, very, very interesting. What are they doing for food, if you don't mind me asking? What's your theory on their diets down there at this level?
Well, of course, we don't know for a fact, but we think that they're high enough technology, food is no impediment. You would have the way of lighting it, and you would have the way of hydroponic, creating hydroponic setups, and you could grow your own food. And we think they prey on surface animals to a certain extent. We think a lot of this cattle mutilation things, they're always taking the tongue, the eyes, and the sex the sky facing eye and the sex organs
and the blood,
and we're not sure if they're using it as part of their breeding, their bizarre breeding program, or if they have subterranean herds that they've taken down themselves thousands of years ago, and these two are possibly becoming non-viable and need regular infusions of DNA from surface-dwelling animals.
Wow.
As possibly being underground is left them with non-viability.
Yeah, less genetic diversity. Also, too, I'd like to interject real quickly that when we found, too, with our research, how similar the vampire mystique is similar to the alien.
Oh, yes, and the incubus and succubus. Yeah, go ahead, Leslie. Too, yeah. Well, when you think about it, they come in the night. They're pale. They have strange eyes.
They're powerful.
They're mm-hmm. able to paralyze you. And they take genetic material away from you in the form of blood. And then the succubus and incubus brings in the sexual component, where they're actually breeding, demons are breeding with us. And it's interesting, I think it was the 6th century, we read an account of one of these succubus births, where the woman gave birth to nothing but air. She had been, it seemed, pregnant, and then this false pregnancy gave birth to nothing but air. Hmm. And that reminds me of the stolen fetus phenomenon. Maybe it's been happening all along. Maybe it's been happening for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Wow. And there you guys tied in some paranormal demonology into this too. The succubus and the incubus, we've mentioned that a lot.
Yeah.
That's very, I love how it ties into all things strange and weird. It's very intriguing. And the theories and the, you have this down, and people, there's some scientists out there. Again, if I was Neil deGrasse Tyson right now, he would obviously, that's the type of scientist he is. He has one track mind. It's all about science. He would just laugh about this, but it's so intriguing because everything you guys said in detail tonight to me, it's believable, because open-minded people have to keep that open mind and hear everything out. And you guys have mentioned
right.
so much
anything,
that ties.
Anything that fits the facts, you can't discount it completely, right?
Right, exactly.
It's a possibility for an explanation if it happens to fit the facts.
Absolutely. Now, I want to take this time for you guys to share all of your plugs, your book, if you have websites, any kind of social media. I see you guys are very busy, podcasts every week now. You guys have your book. So I want to give this time an opportunity for you to share to the listeners all of your plugs so that people can follow you, read your book, and continue to hear your story, which you guys are portraying on your social media now.
Okay, thank you so much. It's the book is called Who They Are and What They're Up To by Leslie and Stephen Shaw. It's available on Amazon and Ingram Books. You know, most people just buy from Amazon, but Ingram is more for bookstores. They prefer that method. So we're on both for for bookstores out there. And we're trying to set up an Instagram page where we're taking people's experiences and making posts out of them. And one at a time, we're releasing episodes of Stephen's bizarre family's experiences, one episode at a time.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And of course, you know, any podcast we do, we make links there to it as well. And reels, of course, and little videos. And we're trying to, you know, make it an educational page for this phenomenon.
We're also ebook too and Kindle.
Oh, and I forgot to tell you the link for that. So Instagram and Facebook have the same handle, and we're at leslie.shaw.author. And Leslie is L-E-S-L-I-E dot S-H-A-W dot author. And then we have a website at whotheyarebook.com where we have excerpts and we did some blogs for a while, and the links to our podcast are there as well. And just stuff like that. And let's see what else. We're gonna start posting our Instagram stuff to TikTok as well, but just haven't got it going yet. I made the account, but haven't started yet. So, well, very soon.
It's very soon. TikTok is. It takes some getting used to. I can tell you that from experience. And even though I'm, you know, 37 years young. When I first started the TikTok stuff, I was like, "How do you do this? How do you get the green screen? How do you do this?" It was, but you'll get the knack to it, and
thank
then,
you for that.
And before you know it, yeah, no, you guys will be up and running. And let me tell you, from when you guys reached out and we started talking, you guys are doing great. I love to see this people in this field do good and share their stories, and you know, share the love, because we are a group of people that in the recent years have become more believable. You know, like I said, 30, 40 years ago, you tell these stories, people look at you. And in the world of paranormal, this group, this field that correlates with everything from UFOs, cryptids, aliens, ghosts, we're starting to be like, we're a close-knit group, and we're sharing each another's stories. And it's a very great thing. And you guys are off to a great start. Like I said, I see your
Thank
stories.
You so
I
much.
See your page. You guys are very well spoken, very intelligent. I feel like I have to go back to college now after speaking with you guys. And
thank you so much.
It's such a great conversation. And I wanted to wholeheartedly thank you for taking this time out tonight to have this conversation on the Say What Again, Billy podcast. You guys are phenomenal. And I wish you nothing but best of luck and more success going forward with your stories. I hope we get another book. And I hope you guys make it to like a television show, because this stuff that you guys are discussing is phenomenal.
Thank you so
much. Thank you so much. We hope for that too.
I needed a good. I needed your okay. kind words tonight.
No, it's not. It's not. It's truthful words, and you know, I love to be kind to people. It's, you know, that's the best bet. Best bet in life is to be kind with one another. But you guys are doing great. You're off and running. And I hope people reach out to you, find you, and your story gets told more. And go read the book. I've combed it. I haven't read the entirety of it because my job, unfortunately, I wish podcasting was my full-time job, but it's not. But it's awesome. You guys are awesome. And I wanted to, again, thank you for coming on the podcast. And this was all made possible by Spotify for Podcasters. If you need a way to get a podcast idea out there, Spotify for Podcasters is the free app that allows you to get your podcasting idea out there on a tablet, on a computer, or even from your phone. So Spotify for Podcasters, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to Leslie and Stephen Shaw. And thank you, Leslie and Stephen, for coming on the podcast tonight.
Thanks, Billy.
You're welcome.
Good night.
Guys, don't be a stranger. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.